You are listening to GeekaBoss Presents Read, Watch, Play. We discuss all things pop culture, including comics, video games, TV, film, and anime.
Hi everyone, this is Billy.
And this is Christoph.
And we are coming to you from a sunny, beautiful day in Sydney.
Yeah, and we just had an awesome opportunity to have a great chat with Brandon Graham, who you know from such comics as
King City
is your favourite. I guess Prophet's probably the thing you're most well known for.
Yeah, and also the magazine Island from Image.
Yeah,
and,
among other things.
Yeah, multiple warheads. But yeah, Brandon was here for Graphic. Me and Christoph went to the talk. Christoph also went to some of the other stuff with Graphic. I think Matt Groening talked.
Yeah,
as well,
which was awesome. And there's going to be a write up on that on the site soon. I'm actually working on. But back to Brandon. He very kindly sat down, had lunch with us, and gave us, you know, like 2 hours of his time to chat.
Yeah. So this isn't really a normal Rewatch Play episode, but yeah.
So just sort of a casual chat with Brandon about his work, his career, and kind of what he also talked about some of his future projects, which sounded really cool.
Yes, they did. So yeah, let us know what you think.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Brandon. We really appreciate it.
Oh, certainly.
Given how many days are you in Australia for?
I think 4 altogether.
Okay. It's not super long, but
yeah, pretty much long enough to. I know about 5 blocks really well. I figure that's pretty much getting the continent down.
Yeah. And you mentioned they're going to take you around to all the comic book stores today.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Awesome. Excellent. As our listeners know, Graphic has been on this weekend, and Brandon Graham's been here as part of a couple of talks that have been going on. We just figured we'd talk about your life and up till now. So yeah, do you want to start?
Yeah, I'm happy to start. Just first up, how was it? What was it like speaking at the Opera House?
I think the idea was a lot more surreal than the experience. It was one of those things that, in retrospect, I looked at a bunch of the sketches I'd done, and people had brought like some of my early porn work, and I was like, oh, you know, I'll just draw like here's a stone erection with a Hellboy character or something, and only in retrospect was I like, oh, that was at the Sydney Opera House that I drew that picture, but it was really a fantastic experience. I kind of I go into a lot of these with the reasonable expectations, I think, that you know, I went up on stage with my friends Phil and Helen, and they were like very worried about being prepared and like what are we going to talk about, and I was much more just like, we'll figure it out. And you know, and I do a lot of public conversations, and this one was by far one of my favorite in recent memory. I think the moderator was just incredibly prepared, and it was just a really casual environment, and everyone working at the Opera House that I met was wonderful. So it was all in all, it was a fantastic experience.
It's kind of nice because, I don't know, in Sydney there's not a whole bunch of stuff that's kind of focused on comics. Like, there's a lot of pop culture centric stuff, but comics kind of get shoved to the sidelines. Right. So Graphic's one of the nice events where we actually get like big talent like yourself out.
And it's a warm environment.
Yeah,
as well,
and also talent that's not necessarily associated with like DC or Marvel.
Right, certainly. Yeah, it creates a really different environment for conversations, because the I'm so used to the commerce being such a part of the conversation, and here it's almost entirely about the you know, it is artistic expression and kind of how it and the community of comics, which is really refreshing.
This is kind of related, because it came up a little bit yesterday. You mentioned that you watched Batman vs Superman on the plane. Do you reckon, because these comic book movies are massive, but they kind of, in some ways, are self-serving, because they only really sell the next comic book movie. Do you think they're ultimately good or bad for the creativity in actual comics?
I feel like they're probably bad for movies, and they're probably not great for comics. But I think they're fine for entertainment, you know? Because, I mean, you know, in movies right now, it just seems really, I think it's kind of depressing that there's no, it seems so rare that the majority of things coming out are pre-existing ideas, rehashed. And that's kind of disappointing, just from a creative point of view, if that's one of the largest ways that people consume art. Then it you know, it's really sad how how much lack of risk there is in it. And I understand it on a business level, but it's on an artistic level, it's just a bummer. Because, like, you know, you can go see, you know, I saw, like, the Magnificent Seven remake the other day.
Yes.
And then I went home and watched Westworld, and I was like, why is Yul Brynner stuff getting remade so much right now?
Yeah.
It's just, it's very surreal. But I think what it does to actual comics, I don't think it affects comics as much as it makes the comic book versions of the movies essentially seem less real than the than the movies in my mind, because oftentimes the movies are actually oftentimes they feel like more successful versions of the thing, like obviously not one-to-one, but
they kind of condense the ideas, I guess.
Yeah, or like Iron Man, I think the film Iron Man is a lot more charming of a character than the comic Iron Man.
Yeah, like a lot of people, because I was working in cinema when that first came out, and a lot of the staff were non-comic book related, were like, oh, you're just saying you liked a comic book, but then they actually went and watched it, and they're like, wow, I really enjoyed this movie, and they've never read a comic in their life. And I think it's just what you said, it makes it more charming.
Yeah, and obviously there's others, like a Hellboy, I think, is a failure as a movie, but a great comic book.
Yeah.
The comics are stylized, like, and so reliant on Mignola's sort of visual tone that I think it was always going to fail as a movie.
Yeah, there's certain things, like taking Mignola out of Hellboy is just like, same thing, like taking Jamie Hewlett, and even Jamie Hewlett and Alan Martin seem fairly involved in the Tank Girl movie, but there's certain things that just, like, they just don't translate. And then you get things like Sin City. The first one I thought was really fun and fantastic and just made me appreciate the comic more. And the second one was a train wreck.
Yeah, I never watched that. Or The Spirit.
The Spirit I actually enjoyed, and I might be one of the rare cases. But I was never a huge Eisner guy, so it's easy for me. And there's little touches in it, like there's a Jeff Darrow original in the movie briefly.
Really?
Staying on comic book movies that you get and not many people are. I think you and me both agree on one particular movie, Constantine.
Oh yeah, I was actually just thinking about that.
I love that film.
Yeah, and I know it's kind of sacrilegious to people that love the comic, but I've always found the Constantine comic books kind of disappointing because I feel like the idea is so strong and the execution is so often doesn't live up to it. So the film throws away so much important elements of the story, but it created something that I connected with much more than the comic books.
Yeah. I don't know, I feel like the comic does seem to be like a constant one, seem more brutal. And I think the movie one was trying to be its own thing, and it did succeed at that, but it just wasn't what everyone expected.
Yeah, Keanu Reeves is very fascinating because no one wants to talk about him being good in movies. It's just like, oh, Keanu Reeves. But he's in so many amazing, fun movies.
I love Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. It makes me believe that, like, oh, it doesn't matter if you act. It matters, you know, it's like, there's people that are obviously great at the craft of acting, and those guys are just like, he's just good at being fun and relatable in a movie.
Well, yeah, his new movie's coming out.
John Wick 2?
Yeah, John Wick 2. Well, I'm getting pumped for it because, you know, it's Keanu Reeves, so yeah.
Nice. And there's always the talk about a new Bill and Ted one.
Yeah. So you grew up in Seattle. Did you always want to draw and create comics?
Yeah, apparently I'd announced it to my mother at the age of 7. And we obviously with less information about what a career in comic books would be.
Sorry, but we only had Solo left.
Oh, that is fantastic. Okay. We've just got our drinks here. We're recording this like crazy people.
Thank you. So, what was the earliest? I'm assuming you started creating comics when you were little as well.
One of my earliest things I did was a comic book redrawing of the Last Unicorn animated movie.
Okay.
Which is, I don't remember drawing it, but I remember, but my mom has it, she shows it to me. And it was literally, I think I just watched the cartoon, and then went home and redrew the story as a comic, and my mom typed out all the dialogue. Yeah, it's interesting. And years later, I even got to do a talk on The Last Unicorn. I'm incredibly unqualified to do it, but I was in Oslo, Norway, and they have a movie theater there, and they're like, do you want to present an animated movie? And I was like, I have no reason. I feel like I'm very oftentimes get offered projects that I am not, I should not be doing, but it's too interesting an idea to not take.
Mm. So, I read somewhere that you dropped out of school just to focus on comics.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot more to it than that, but essentially I dropped out of school and I was very not, I wasn't, I didn't function very well in school, I was very antisocial.
Sewing cat?
But, I quit with the idea of like, oh, I'll just be a professional artist, and obviously that idea at 16 is very different from the reality of it. I feel like through stubbornness I managed to kind of succeed, but it took a very long time. Partially because I have no other skills and I have a tattoo on my neck.
And is that around the same time that you started doing graffiti as well? Or
the graffiti came a little later.
Okay.
I was kind of old in graffiti in the sense that it's generally something that people do when they're around, you know, 13 to 20, just because they the laws are much more lenient then, and you know, adults generally, unless you become really into it, a lot of people drop out. A lot of tattoo artists started out as graffiti writers. A lot of people kind of move on from it. But I think for me, a big part of it was that was the community that was in Seattle making art that I had access to. I didn't really meet other people that did comic books until much later.
Okay.
But I developed a lot of my ideas about a lot of things I've kind of reworked in later years, but a lot of my initial ideas about kind of how a community works were from graffiti. And I think it's actually, it's something I'm adjusting to, but it's the culture in how people talk about art and comic books is so different from how people talk about art and graffiti that it really is something, graffiti's a much harsher critique. There's much more like, did somebody earn their place here? Is somebody like, you can talk about people's skills and abilities much more openly than sometimes in comics.
Why do you think that is? Just because the delivery method's different, or the
I think it's honestly just that it's a bunch of it's a lot of teenage machismo in graffiti, and everyone's trying to bump their shoulders together and prove themselves. And comic books, it's generally less of a it's just much more. I mean, the money is involved in it much more, and there's a lot of, I think a lot of it comes down to money. A lot of it's that there's sometimes a impression that the cartoonists, especially like kind of mainstream professional cartoonists, shouldn't speak critically of each other's work because they're kind of all in it together, and that's something that I think is detrimental sometimes to the conversation.
Yeah, I think it can get a bit insular, and I hear online a lot in sort of comics talking about that the comic book industry is quite incestuous in terms of the sort of talent pool. And
yeah, I mean, it becomes a thing of like, you know, DC Comics announces we've got the top guys in the industry working on here. I always do the math in my head, and I'm just like, oh, they mean this, and they mean these guys they always work with. They didn't go outside of their sphere at all.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because they did the, I don't know if you heard about the DC talent hunt, which was to bring in new talent, and the guys they picked were all talented, except that they were all already working in the industry in some capacity.
And that's a huge problem across the board, I think, is I think that people get so invested in kind of how they see comics that oftentimes on the publishing end they don't really kind of know how to find new people.
Like, in terms, do you reckon they have a fairly strict vision about what comics?
I don't know what it is, honestly, because I find it very easy to find new people. I find digging up creators that whose work inspires me to be something that I actually need to do my own work. It's really helpful.
Was that part of why you started Island, to be able to give these people the voice?
It's very much, and also just to kind of make a space for the kinds of comics books that I was really excited to read.
Back to graffiti. I guess my initial exposure to graffiti was through the video game Jet Set Radio Future.
Okay. It's a very nice video game.
Yeah, and like I just remember someone doing their own tag in the game, like you could upload it and it was like a tag of He-Man in front of Castle Grayskull. I was like, that's amazing. But one thing I would you get into the other parts of like I guess the culture of graffiti, like hip hop, rap, breakdancing and stuff like that? And that did that influence at all on your writing, like so for example puns and whatnot?
Oh yeah, the puns is a huge thing. Yeah, so I mean, the Seattle graffiti community is very, the hip hop community in Seattle is very tied to. A lot of it back then was kind of almost like purists about hip hop. Like they wouldn't refer to themselves as b-boys unless they were like did like most or all of the elements of hip hop. Mm. So those guys that were like.
What about places you would tag?
There's a lot of rules for that as well, so that's something.
Oh, okay.
Like, there's a guy named Upski who wrote a book called Bomb the Suburbs, and in it he actually listed the kind of unofficial rules of graffiti, and that became much more strict among like teenagers doing it. There are things like, you know, you don't write on people's homes, you don't write on churches, you don't write on nature, you know?
Yeah.
If you go over someone's work, there's kind of respectful ways to do it. Like, if you do a piece, you know, if you do like a tag, then somebody just tagging over it is very disrespectful. But if somebody does a throw up or a piece over it, a throw up is kind of like a bubbly, quickly done thing, and then a piece is like a masterpiece, which is kind of like the highest level of thing you can do there. And so doing specific things over it. And I remember in Seattle there were people that like, if somebody like tagged a mural, there were people that would like find that person and beat them up.
Wow.
So it's very, and not always, but a lot of it within
that's
the community.
The original call-out culture.
What's that?
That's the original call-out culture.
The original call-out culture, yeah.
I don't know, I think in Australia, like I mean, Sydney and Melbourne, don't want to make it a Sydney versus Melbourne thing, but I do think like, Sydney doesn't treat graffiti art as like an art form as much as Melbourne does. Like there's a lot of laneways in Melbourne where there's amazing graffiti. If you ever get a chance to go to Melbourne, you should definitely check out the laneways. But yeah, I mean in Sydney there's a lot of pieces that have been made, you know, as expression against the government, local government here and stuff, and it's all just been painted over and treated as if reckless youth type thing. As opposed to in Melbourne, it would be very much like keep it up as a piece of art.
Yeah, I mean, the Seattle, certainly the city was never very interested in graffiti. I mean, they were interested in it, but not in any way that the graffiti writers were fond of. It was very, I remember a lot of, there's a lot of clashes over clubs doing, and, you know, in America, there's certainly a lot of things tied with that in the race, obviously.
Okay.
So there were things where certain clubs would just like not have anything related to hip hop because they didn't like the crowd that showed up. And
yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I know a lot of strip clubs will specifically be like, you know, none of that rap music in here, and it's a strip club.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the strip to rap is the problem.
Oh, there's entire rap albums that are made for strippers. Yeah.
Bumping and grinding.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's the dirty South is better.
So I'm pretty sure Mobius was an influence on you.
Oh yeah, ridiculously. So I probably owe his family a check.
Yeah. What about other things like Korean comics or even like Japanese comics and manga and stuff like that?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, the Japanese stuff was really big to me because Seattle has a big Asian community, and I would go to Japanese grocery stores. There's a place called Yuajimaya, and I'd go there and buy the big weekly telephone book sized comic books. And years later in New York, I would get Korean comics and French comics and basically anything I'd find from around the world that was exciting to me.
Do you still read much manga now, or is it sort of your tastes have moved elsewhere?
I have a problem in that a lot of my favorite work in the world, especially outside of America, is 20 years old now, and it's not that the work has suffered as much as I think that my wheelhouse is stuck back then.
Hey.
Hey.
What about anime? Is anime bigger influence or is it more manga?
Want to pull up a chair?
Yeah.
Join us.
Have you guys met?
No, hi.
I'm Christoph. Lovely to meet you.
Really?
You're in a very casual interview. anime.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing where at the time of, earlier on, it was like I was obsessive about watching things in languages I couldn't understand, and later on, I got much lazier. And it was things like, actually, when I was living in New York, I was kind of not paying attention to a lot of it, and then a friend of mine started showing me things like Furry Curry and Cowboy Bebop that were kind of.
I was about to mention, like, that was the first sort of big anime that I was introduced to, and it's just stuck with me, Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about that last night. That one, it's a little too good. You were talking about trying to explain Cowboy Bebop to somebody that hadn't seen it. And for me, it's just, like, the problem with shows like that, it's like, I had the same thing with, like, Stranger Things show that was on TV recently. It's a problem when something is quality in a way that other things... It's what do you follow it up with, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing, it's I don't mean to, like, brown nose you or put you up or anything, but like I feel like King City to me is like sort of Cowboy Bebop. Like it's up there with some of my favorite stuff. And like I like how Cowboy Bebop is singular. They haven't done any sequels or anything like that. I mean, there was a movie that was released during the run of it.
Yeah.
It's like they've done it, they've put a bow on it, and they've moved on to other stuff.
Yeah, and even Cowboy Bebop, the way it was done, I know the creator of it's talked about how, the Japanese animation industry has changed so much, they don't even, I mean, most of the stuff's animated in Korea and India now. And so even the culture, it's this kind of weird thing of like, you know, America hires, in the 1980s and 70s, America hires Japanese animators to make cartoons over here, and then the Japanese industry flourishes and they start hiring out places, and then you get Korean animation, and it's kind of this, I'm wondering if it'll eventually move back to America where you get, you know, you get India hiring American animators and actually build up an industry here again, which would be interesting. Which, it's funny because that would mean America would be like a third world country, but it'd probably be good for animation.
One thing I do like about anime is a lot of the people involved, like, say, for example, Cowboy Bebop, they then will team up again even a few years later to do other stuff.
Yeah, like Samurai Champloo?
Yeah, or even, I think it's Strangers on a Slope and Space Dandy.
Space Dandy, right, that was one of them.
So, you mentioned New York. How long were you in New York before you met the group that sort of became Midhouse?
I guess the it's kind of a... So, I was in New York and knew no artists and kind of didn't know what I was doing there. And I went into a Starbucks and there was a guy just drawing at a table. And it was weird because at that time, like I remember being a teenager, if I saw someone wearing a Japanese animation shirt, I would go up and talk to them. And now that seems insane. But
I do it sometimes.
Good. And so the idea of just like, oh, there's a person drawing, I'm going to talk to them. And it turned out to be LaShawn Thomas, who went on to... do the Boondocks cartoon, and he worked on Black Dynamite, and then he's got his own cartoon called Cannon Busters that's being made now. So he turned into a very major figure in American animation, and especially in like kind of as far as like black animators making Japanese animation or influence work in America. I feel like he's kind of the pinnacle of that right now, which is really amazing that I casually bumped into this guy. And he was a huge help to me in New York, introducing me to people that he worked with, and he got me a job at this place called Urban Box Office that was like a almost like a American Afrocentric flash animation company.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing I did Dominican booty videos there. I worked for a guy named Oral Salido. He's Solid Gold. Which talks about, he did a song called If I Was President, which is basically like, he would just sexually harass people a lot. And no one should vote for him.
But, so Trump.
Yeah. I mean, not as bad, but. he'd be if he was on the ticket against Trump, I'd still go for him. in UBO, there's a group of people there that I always jokingly refer to as the Island of White, because they were the only, like, Caucasian dudes that were working there. And in that was was my friend Farrell Dalrymple, who was one of the guys who started Meat House. And at the time, I felt like he was the first, like, he was one of the first, like, real cartoonists that I ever met. Somebody who really, like, published comics and had devoted their life to it. And it was really exciting to me.
Okay, and you were doing porn comics at the time as well.
Yeah, soon. So another guy that I'd met earlier on in Seattle was a guy named Justin Norman, who's the pen name Moritat. He's actually the artist on Hellblazer right now.
So
I was assisting on his porn comics, and I always have to qualify, it was so long ago that he had a picture of Angelina Jolie hung on his wall from the movie Hackers, and nobody knew who she was. People would be like, who's that?
I love Hackers.
The best movie ever made.
Yeah.
So Moritat brought me into his publisher, NBM, and they do a lot of French translated work, and a lot of it's very highbrow. They have a thing called Comics Lit, where they publish things, like they have a book called The Blue Notebook by André Julliard. I'll screw up his name, but it's fantastic French comic books, and they have things that are like all pastels and everything. And so I went in there with a very high-minded, like, I'm gonna do art comics. And they were like, ink this porn. And so I did that for a while, and then eventually they let me do some of my own work. And it got to the point where it was very, very restrictive in a lot of ways, where I had to bring in, my pages had to be approved, and if they didn't have enough sex on them, they would get cut.
Yeah.
And so they had me do they specifically at one point were like, your other comics, or I did this thing called Perverts of the Unknown, and they're like, that's a little too weird, where lesbian schoolgirl stuff is selling right now, so do that. And so I got a bunch of their books that were on that subject, and I basically just tried to make a book making fun of those books, which came out, I think, it's a weird mix of, like, I tried to make, when I was doing the adult stuff, I tried to make it really light and fun, because I didn't want it to be creepy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was also very ridiculous, because the subject, you can't get out from under what it is.
Yeah. So just jumping forward a little bit, what was it like when you first started working at Tokyo Pop and kind of doing your own stuff, or at least comics that weren't in that genre?
So I'm pre Tokyo Pop. So pre Tokyo Pop, there was a weird. I spent a long time trying to break into comics in New York, and like I would go up to Vertigo every week or so, and just like desperately like be like I would do short stories that I would bring them and show them. That eventually I collected. I did so many short stories to drop off at Vertigo that I made a collection of them eventually, of just kind of my own stuff. But that was very much a catch-22 where they wouldn't hire me for stuff unless I established a name, and I couldn't establish a name unless they hired me for stuff. So it was really like a dead end. And then eventually and that was an interesting situation because I go to all these parties and got to meet guys like Paul Pope and Frank Miller and this kind of New York comic book scene, which did feel very closed off at that time.
Yeah. Like, fairly clicky, or just kind of hard to get into?
They were very welcoming, and that, like, oh, come to our parties and hang out. But it's always that situation that if you're a struggling artist and the idea of, like, I think it's just hard to see what it's like to be broke if you're not broke and making art.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
It's really, it's like if you're just, like, you know, I mean, if you're getting paid $500 a page and somebody's rent is $500 and they're just like, I just give me one page, it's very different.
Was that around the time you were making Multiple Warheads and sort of jotting stuff down to become King City as well?
Yeah, well, Multiple Warheads are, so basically at a certain point I hit a dead end with the adult comics and with the Vertigo pitches, where I just realized that, like, I didn't know anyone at the publishers anymore, or they told me, like, don't bring us stuff for a while, we're not interested in anything right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really formative in just realizing that, like, I for the first time in years, I just kind of didn't know where to go next. And so I just started making King City, and it was called Cat Master back then, just as a personal project that was entirely just for myself. And there's a lot of stuff in it where it's like I would go to conventions. I remember I went up to a publisher at one point, and I just had photocopies of the original King City, and I was just like, oh, this is cool. I'll show him my book, see what he thinks. And he just ripped it apart, and he was just like, your perspective's wrong here, your anatomy's wrong here. And it's funny because I think a lot of people would take that as like, oh, I learned some things from this, but I still don't like that guy. I'm just like, because it's probably just my own pettiness, but I'm just like, seriously, I'll look back at those pages sometimes and I'll be like, that perspective's right.
Yeah.
Has that kind of influenced why you're such a hands-off editor in terms of, you said yesterday, you just kind of bring in talented people and trust them to...
Yeah, very much so. I don't think it improves the work to be a heavy-handed editor. I mean, maybe it does for certain people. I have friends... my friend Marley Zarcone, who draws Shade the Changing Girl right now, she really like loves having a really heavy interaction with her editorial team, and that makes no sense to me, but because for me it's like I feel like I'm competent in my work, and I am having somebody who... It's good to not... I think I really enjoy the Emperor's New Clothes aspect of comics. Just the idea that if I put down a line, that will go to print, and, you know, thousands and thousands of copies of that will be seen. And having to have that approved, I think, just creates a wall between the work and the reader that I don't think... I personally wouldn't benefit from it. So I really don't want to put that on anyone else.
Okay.
And I go to the point where I go to extremes where sometimes I try not to look at work too much that I'm going to publish, because I'm like, I'm not going to tell them to change anything anyway. And luckily, Image has people that go over and do spell checks and everything. I wouldn't be good at spell checks either, so...
Because didn't Phil Barlow say yesterday you only read for one of his comics after it had gone to print?
Yeah. Which is something I generally don't tell people, but I operate that way too much. Because it's so exciting. You get a package in the mail, and you're like, oh, it's one of my favorite cartoonists and their new book.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it would be so much less fun if you just... I mean, some things I can't help but read because I'm too excited about it, but if I can hold off, I love just getting a package and sitting down and reading the book.
I guess you get that excitement of discovery.
Yeah.
So... Kingsley was coming out through Tokyo Pop.
Yeah, and I got the Tokyo Pop gig through Becky Cloonan, who's writing Punisher now, I believe.
Yes, she is.
She was actually LaShawn Thomas's assistant way back when.
Yes, and she's also doing a series with the collaborator.
That's right, through Image?
Yeah, Andy.
Andy.
Which is, like, I'm glad she's writing, but I'm kind of sad she's not doing as much
art anymore. Yeah, because I really love her art.
I always... joke with her about how she's got some kind of curse on her where she refuses to write and draw one comic book and give it decent distribution, because she does work, she'll do like photocopied zines or small press kind of zines that are fantastic that she writes and draws everything.
Like, I think Demeter is one that she did.
When I was in the UK, the cool thing about the UK is they do a lot of these things called book plates.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For trades, which they don't do really here. I haven't seen it much in the States. And I bought her collection, was being sold in a comic book store in the UK, and it also had like a book plate of hers that she'd drawn.
Right, it's probably Gosh Comics.
Yeah, I think it was Gosh. It's a really great place, Gosh. So I think I read, was it about halfway through King City that Tokyo Pop sort of started to...
Yeah, basically it's very boring, but essentially one of the major people they were selling to was the larger book chains in America, and one of those stores just tanked.
Yeah.
And so the bubble popped on who Tokyo Pop was selling their work to, and I think a lot of what they were operating on was essentially just the idea of like, people like manga, so let's just bulk, just put as much manga on the shelves as we can.
Mm.
And to this day, I don't know if they had some good stuff, but I don't know if they had any like big hits.
So they only waited because like now the whole thing is about buying, a lot more people buy trades these days. They'd last a few more years.
Yeah, and Tokyo Pop didn't really, I don't think they understood at all about how to, I mean there was a big stigma back then about American made manga felt very false. And so they were trying to create a line of their own manga. And they had some fantastic creators. They had like Becky Cloonan and Sophie Campbell, and there's just a ton of great people doing stuff there. But it was weird because Becky at the time was like doing very successful DC comics, and they couldn't even like sell her stuff through Tokyo Pop. She finished an entire book that never came out.
Whoa! Wow.
Yeah, the second, what was it called? East Coast Rising.
Oh, wow.
Kind of New Jersey Pirates.
So.
And they also were horrible in dealing with, like.
Because I heard rumors that they were coming back and a whole bunch of creators were not happy about that because they mistreated.
Yeah, they're just a very poorly run. I mean, some of the people I worked with there were really good, but just the structure and the guy in charge is just a.
Sounds a bit like Dreamwave.
Like what's there?
How Dreamwave from a little bit.
Very, very different, but I mean, both bad, obviously. Tokyo Pop paid, but I mean, my problem with the Tokyo Pop thing is that the contract was so screwy. Like, the rights for King City are all screwed up now. And the. Yeah, I mean, Image helped me out. That's a huge reason why I'm at Image, is that Eric Stevenson and Joe Keating at Image, like, they. When Tokyo Pop went under on publishing the books, I contacted everyone I could think of to get me in there and try to help to kind of save King City coming out. Actually, Tokyo Pop wouldn't speak to me. I had to piss them off to get them on the phone.
Yeah, I remember. I think you put your stuff online.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which they specifically didn't want, and so they called me up to yell at me. And at that point, I'd actually had Image being willing to publish them, but they wouldn't talk to anyone. So it was one of those weird things where, like, It's just insane how the company ran. Because, like, I had to explain to the head of Tokyo Pop at one point who Eric Stevenson was, just the publisher of Image. And it was this kind of embarrassing thing where I was like, I don't want to be insulting, but, like, this is your job,
yeah.
You know? You guys work in comics.
You should know who, like, the other industry figures
are. Yeah, do you have Google? Can you check it out? Do I have to explain it to you?
But you were obviously eventually able to get them in some capacity the rights so you could put it in Image?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So did the rights go? Is the rights back with you an Image, or
they're kind of a mess. Basically, Image is doing whatever. Image is continuously publishing it, and it's in print and coming out. I shouldn't even be as cruel about it. I try to deal with Tokyo Pop as little as possible, and I suspect that the entirety of the rights will revert to me at a certain point. But at this point, it's staying in print. Is kind of the important thing for me.
Okay.
I mean, it's great on its own, but I guess if it ever moved back to you, would you consider a sequel or another
movie? I've thought about it, but I feel like it's such a piece of work of me in my late 20s that I don't know what the hell. I wouldn't want to, you know, I wouldn't want a Dark Knight 2 it or whatever. I wouldn't want to make something that just felt like a completely different thing because I'm in a different place. Yeah.
Okay. Would it almost be like trying to add to a time capsule?
It very much is a time capsule. Which at the time was very frustrating to me because I felt like it was like the best thing I had, and it maybe is the best thing I had, but it's very much of that time, and I kind of have to move on.
One of the things I really like about King City and Multiple Warheads is that it's filled to the brim every single page. There's always, besides the main story, there's all these like side stories, and then side story on the side. There's all these tiny things going on.
I was saying this to Billy, it's almost like you remind me of a comedian in the way you're sort of just riffing on the page. How do you get from that idea on the page and still have that rawness to it without, like, do you just kind of jump straight into drawing? Do you have an outline that you're working from?
I have outlines. I think of it, I call that layering, where essentially in film, you are watching a single screen or whatever, and it is a progression of images and scenes. And if there's something else going on aside from the main story, you have to rewind it and pause it or anything. But in comics, because it's a static image, you can hold on that, and you can really, like, not only focus on something in the foreground, but you can focus on what the character's holding, you can focus on the background. It's like and you can even make multiple times happening at once. You can have, like, you know, you can make a long panel and have different actions. You can have someone yelling and someone reacting to the yelling, and someone reacting to that person yelling in a single image, and on and on and on. You can do a ton with it that kind of no other medium is really as adept for. And so I like to play with that a lot. And oftentimes when I'm writing this stuff, I'll give myself a base. I'll be like, this idea I think is solid enough to hold this thing. And then once I have that, I can keep playing with it and just kind of joke around with it myself and see where else it can go. And that's a big part of the fun for me.
Is your process with Prophet similar? Because I think I read that you're pretty, like, loose in terms of working with the artist. You don't give them, like, a full script or anything.
Instrumentally. Actually, what I do is I... it might be insanely controlling as much as it seems more handoff to me, but I actually draw the entire comic out in rough layouts. And I do them in color, just because I do it in Photoshop.
Okay.
And then I make a really ugly version of the whole book, and then I send it to the artists, and they change things. And oftentimes they change things less than I want, and sometimes they change it more, but then I go back and I do I rework the script, and sometimes talking with the artists about, like, what were you doing in this page? Like, what did this monster come from? And we'll talk it over. Which sometimes it's funny how mixed that can be. Like, sometimes they'll be like, oh, I had this whole idea. Like, that guy's there because he's doing this. And oftentimes they'll be like, I don't know. I don't remember what I was up to there. And so it becomes a really fun back and forth about just,
like, I can imagine it results in, because the thing I noticed about Prog is how much, like, there's so little dialogue because images are always doing, like, most of the heavy lifting stories.
Absolutely. Which creates a really interesting thing in the conversation about it, because it certainly makes me understand how it's really weird how much weight goes to comic book writers these days when so much of the heavy lifting is art.
It's weird because it takes I write comics and takes me like 10 minutes to write a page. It's gonna take an artist like a couple of hours to.
Text for things like that, and it's very different when I'm hand lettering stuff, but if I do like a profit issue, I get the art back, and I do a thing I call drunk pass, which is just the worst garbage text version of it. I'll just write out, and a lot of my writing works this way too, is my initial ideas are more often than not just garbage, and then And at the time, it's a scary thing, is at the time it doesn't occur to me that they're bad. I'll just be like, here's a good idea, and I'll write down a script, and then I'll let it sit a day, and I'll come back and I'll reread it, and I'll suddenly be like, oh, this is written by just like a crazy person has broken into my home and just, like, written garbage on this, like somebody tied a monkey to this computer and just had them type, and then I just rework it and repolish it. Usually I'll do a drunk pass, I'll polish it up in a second pass, and then I'll send it off to usually Simon Roy and sometimes Marion Churchland, and they'll very harshly critique it and change entire passages of it and send it back to me, and I'll do a final version.
Awesome. Speaking on profit, curious how that started and also how it came about to involve all the various other artists?
So it's basically... it started as a whole plan to relaunch a bunch of Rob Liefeld's 90s stories.
Was that Rob's idea, or was it Image's idea?
It was Eric Stevenson and Image's idea. And, so there was Youngblood, Prophet, Glory, and, Bloodstrike, I think?
Okay. I don't know heaps about those 90s stuff. I didn't read Glory, though.
Okay, yeah. I think Prophet and Glory were the farthest from... They're the ones that kind of took the most liberties with the...
Yeah.
And Glory is Joe Keating and Sophie Campbell doing it. And, And that one... And, you know, me and Joe and Sophie are all good friends. So it was fun to kind of see what they were doing and see what
got... It's such a pity that book got cancelled, because they were doing really cool things.
Yeah. I think it was... it was one of those weird things where... It's all inside baseball stuff, but I think a lot of retailers remember Liefeld's name from the 90s and weren't really keen on the idea of relaunches of his work.
Yeah, I guess some of his work hasn't aged, or people feel like it hasn't aged super well.
I think a lot of it is even less... I mean, it was this weird, you know, it's... Yeah, it's just that bubble of where it was at. It was like if you take... you take music from 25 years ago and are just like, check out this new song, like a lot of it will just be like, oh, that was way back then, that's just a different time. And initially I turned down doing Prophet, because they wanted me to write and draw it at first, and I'd never collaborated with anyone before. And then Joe got the idea. He was like, your friend Simon, because I just met Simon recently and we're hanging out and doing and kind of talking comic books a lot, and he was like, why don't you get him to draw it? And Simon was in art school then, so it didn't seem like a big risk. The joke at the time, so we were at a convention, and I said, alright, give me like a day to think about it, And Stevenson was fantastic, and he was like, you have total freedom, I won't shoot down any idea you do, you can just do it, which is very appealing. And I went to the bathroom, and I'd come back, and Moritat actually had written Prophet on the cover of my sketchbook. Nice. And I was like, well, I have to take the job or else I'm giving you a sketchbook.
And, high stakes.
And another friend of mine made the joke, like, he did it for the money. He couldn't get away from the pun. It's like doing it for the profit.
Nice. How did you meet some of the other artists? How did you meet Yannis?
It's Yanni. It's like the new age musician. So Yanni and Simon I met right around the same time, and I met them both. I think Yanni and Simon knew each other through the internet. Mm. Simon actually met at a release party for his book, Jan's Atomic Heart. It was actually published by the letterer of Prophet, Ed Brisson. He had a small press company in Vancouver. And Yanni sent me, we were all very influenced by the same stuff. A lot of it was tied to a lot of like William Gibson's work was very much something we were all connected to, and just like just lots of 70s and 80s science fiction novels.
Yeah, I've read Yanni's
Old City Blues.
Old City Blues, and right. It does have a very noir Robotech feel to it.
Yeah, it's very much his like love letter to Tony Takazaki and Masamune Shirow and all those guys. And it's interesting because it's not a commentary on that work. It's just literally like him doing that type of work,
like his version of it.
Yeah,
I'm really excited for his Jar Jar.
Yeah, I think he's the perfect artist to do that.
Yeah,
and it's weird because a lot of guys like on G.I. Joe, it's like what's their spin, and in Yanni, it's just like he's gonna do a Yanni comic. I get it.
Nice. So as well as Prophet, you've got. Working with, like, collaborating with everyone, did that sort of give you the, the collaborator bug to want to do, like, Island and Eight House?
Yeah, I mean, one of the major things for it is it gave me the creative freedom of the image, essentially. Mm. One of those things where I quickly realized that Stevenson and the other people at Image were interested in backing whatever I wanted to do, and for the first time in my life it was suddenly like I have complete creative freedom, and it's like, what do you do with that? And so I started thinking about what my ideal goal would be in comics, and I'm very community based, so the idea of finding spaces to work with other artists and finding spaces where artists who I'm excited about can come in and I can throw money at them was a very exciting idea. You know, things like getting Phil Barlow's Zooniverse reprinted was a huge thing for me because that was one of the biggest comics to me growing up. And it's one of those things I'm always talking about, and then people are like, how do I find it? And I'm like, I don't know.
The difference between Eight House and Island is almost like a magazine where everyone can tell their anthology types of short stories, and Eight House is a shared universe.
Right, exactly. I feel like they're both kind of offshoots of Prophet. In a way where Eight House is very much artists working off each other, and Island is much more individuals doing their own work and putting them under one cover.
Well, I feel like we probably should wrap up because we almost take an hour of your time to eat. But I just quickly wanted to ask you, in regards to Island, you bring in a lot of new talent, and we mentioned before the industry is a little bit incestuous. Whose responsibility do you think it is to bring in new talent? Do you think it falls to the creators, or do you think the publishers should be doing more initiatives to be finding new people?
I think it's good. It's nice when creators do it because readers oftentimes will connect more if a creator says, "Look at this work I'm really excited about." But I think it's kind of the life's blood of a publisher. I think publishers not doing it seems insane to me. It seems like absolutely the most important thing a publisher could be doing is looking for the next thing to be publishing, because there's so much bizarre stuff in comics where obviously you want to, it's a mixed bag, because I think it's very important to respect the creators who have come before and to make sure that, like oftentimes in pop culture, like what's newest is always the most exciting. And I think that that's like it becomes really bizarre, the idea like novelist is like, you know, people don't assume that somebody's first novel will be their best novel, because people get better as they work more. And in comics, you know, in a lot of things, especially in music, it's like somebody comes out at, music is super depressing because it's like somebody comes out at 19 and that's when you see them, and if they develop as an artist years later, it's like, oh, they're a producer now, you'll never hear another song from them on the radio.
Yeah, I think there's a few musical people that are like that. The, I think the producer. But yeah, no, I understand that. Like, I don't know, just focus on one work and don't watch someone grow.
Yeah, and I think it's, so it's both, and that's something I'm both trying to do on Island, is having older cartoonists whose work I respect a lot, and also making a place for newer cartoonists. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it's really important.
Some of your like past work, if you did more of it, like say for example Infinite Warriors, mm-hmm. would you bring that through Island, or is it separate?
So I'm actually, the next book I'm doing, I've finished almost all of the stuff that I'm writing for other people. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of shelving that for a couple years, and I'm going to just focus on editing Island with Amarillo's. And Image has asked me to do, basically they asked me to relaunch, or they said do something a lot like King City. So I think they want me to do something with more of a narrative, because Warheads is all over the place.
Mm.
And I think In Profit very much has, and In Profit and 8 House and stuff has a very different tone than King City stuff. So, the idea was to put out a monthly comic book that essentially they suggested just being like, put out like Brandon Graham comics. And I've been kicking around this idea, which might be idiotic, but I kept thinking about when Scott Pilgrim came out, everyone would refer to Brian O'Malley as Scott Pilgrim. And so I was thinking, like, what happens if I just publish a comic called Brandon Graham and just every month just put whatever I'm working on it? And I have two major stories that I'm working on for that now. One is about a man who lives in a giant walking city. It's kind of like a story called Elephant. It's a guy who, about his life inside of a city that's constantly moving and communicating with other cities, and they're all being attacked by, the cities keep getting destroyed by a kind of giant unseen monster.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's a shorter story. And then I'm doing a longer one, which I don't really have a name for right now, but it's essentially about a super thief who implants his brain inside of a genetically engineered butler so he can watch over a young woman that was the daughter of a friend of his, and make sure that she's protected while she's getting run through essentially like a Hunger Games scenario. That's
awesome.
That's with so they're kind of training her to be an immortal, and I based her off of Josephine Baker, and he's this weird he looks like a butler with a tail.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Brandon.
Yeah,
we really appreciate it.
That's
it. Well, if you haven't checked out Brandon's work, please do.
You can get his work at most comic book stores or bookstores.
Do you read, is there a book that you'd say is a good jumping on point for people who haven't really been exposed to your work before?
I generally tend to tell people to start with either Profit or King City, because they're you know, both of them have a beginning, middle, and end. King City's more personal and more comedic, but Profit, I think, is there's a lot more of Profit, and it's on some levels maybe they're for different readers. I don't know, but I'd say if people are interested, they should check out one of those, and if they like them, then dig up all the other stuff. And something that's been really fantastic about touring around lately is seeing people that, if they connect with my work, then oftentimes they'll connect with the work of people that I am around, and a lot of my friends' work. And so it's people like discovering my stuff and then seeing like 20 other artists around me and finding all this stuff that they're excited about, which is really great.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Cool, thank you.
You've been listening to GigaBoss Presents. Read, watch, play. We discussed all things pop culture, including comics, video games, TV, film, and anime.